The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Our guest tonight has many predecessors. Think Spillane, Thompson, Gudis, Chandler. But there isn't anyone putting pen to paper with the speedball rhythms and imaginative ferocity of James Ellroy. His plots take on American history with a capital H. His sentences shimmer with more sonic sweetness than most poetry of the past 50 years. His characters have gutters for souls. In James Ellroy's world, you're guilty until you're proven dead. In James Ellroy's world, darkness is visible. James Ellroy.
T.S. Eliot wrote, "If you came this way, starting from anywhere, in any time and in any season, it would always be the same. You would have to put off sense and notion. You are not here to instruct yourself or to inform curiosity or to carry report. You are here to kneel where prayer has been proven valid." And for me, James Ellroy, the demon dog of American literature and a product of America's public library system, there is no better place on earth for me to bow my head in prayer, to exalt the printed word over cyberspace in the war between the book and the internet invaders. Yeah! I am the author of 17 books, masterpieces all. They precede all my future masterpieces. These books will leave you reamed, steamed, and dry cleaned, tied, dyed, swept to the side, screwed, blued, tattooed, and bafongooed. They are books for the whole fucking family. If the name of your family is the Manson family. Brown's Requiem, Clandestine, Blood on the Moon, Because the Night, Suicide Hill, Killer on the Road, The Black Dahlia, The Big Nowhere, L.A. Confidential, White Jazz, Hollywood Nocturnes, Crime Wave, Destination Morgue, My Dark Places, American Tabloid, The Cold 6000, and now, Blood's a Rover. Tonight, I am going to tell you the story of a mystical deliverance involving a scruffy-coated, tall, skinny dog and a baby boy who became a tall, skinny man. For this, we will have to traverse backwards 61 years of American history to learn why the tall, skinny man wrote the definitive work on American history, my novel just published. But it's the tall, skinny dog who exemplifies literacy in America and in the world as no other creature, living, dead, mystical, or real, has ever done. Who is he? I'll give you a clue. He's now 94 years old. He's approaching his centenary. You guessed it. It's the Borzoi, the symbol of the world's greatest publisher, Alfred A. Knopf. This dog became the Knopf Colophon mascot symbol and predictor of great literature in 1915. He was there with them all in the 20s. Fitzgerald, Gertrude Stein, Zora Neale Hurston, Hemingway, Mencken, man, John Hersey, Thomas Wolfe. He knew them all. He published them all. And if he couldn't publish them, he tried to publish them all. But the fucking Borzoi saw some bad juju coming in the fall of 2008. And he knew that American literature needed a savior. Publishing was flying high from 1915 through the Roaring Twenties, the Great Depression, the Big War, up through the post-war boom. But then the Borzoi, who frankly drank a lot and took a lot of drugs, had a vision of the internet invaders and the 2008 stock market dump. And he was terrified that he'd be shit out of luck and sleeping in a Magnavox box under the 10 freeway in L.A. Cut to Los Angeles. And a star shines on Wilshire Boulevard above Good Samaritan Hospital on the cold winter night of March 4th, 1948. There's a good-looking woman named Hilliker, a red-haired nurse from the Wisconsin boonies. And she's been shacked up with a hunky, Homeric-hung drifter named Elroy. And damned if they didn't breed, pop that evil frog, yours truly, into a baby bed like this. And already I was lying there looking for trouble. Books, drugs, women, glory, books, drugs, booze, women, glory. I'm like this. Of course, my schvance was like that. Books, drugs, glory, women, booze. Bam! And all of a sudden, there's a rustling in the room. And bam, a big, scruffy, skinny-snouted dog puts his paws on the edge of my baby bed and says, "Brother, publishing is flying high right now, but I foresee some evil shit 60 years down the line. The temptations of cyberspace, hyperkinetic motion pictures, the death of the printed word, coupled with a stock market dump, and what we need is a motherfucker to explain American history in the most engaging, sexy, groovy, swinging, accessible terms to a whole new generation, a reader fucked up on the internet and having no bread. Can you dig it, Elroy?" I thought about it. Thought about it for a couple of minutes. And I said, "Get your paws off my crib, you furry cocksucker. I got a lot of living to do first." If the past 61 years of American history can be explained by a mystical presence, it is the Alfred A. Knopf Borzoi. If 1958 to 1972 can be explained through the genius of one man, it is me in the creation of my underworld USA trilogy. American Tabloid, 58 to 63. The Cold 6000, 63 to 68. And now the concluding volume, Blood's a Rover, 68 to 72. But it wasn't easy for me to get there because I had a lot of living to do first. Let's go forward a little bit. The hunky Homericong drifter, my dad, gopher for Rita Hayworth, never worked a day in his life, relied on that donkey Dick and his big dreams. But he taught me to read when I was 3 years old, and he dropped me off at the public library when I was that high. And I read, and I started looking around. And I started thinking, maybe there's a different version of the world that people are not telling me. How did I know this? For one thing, the two great influences of my life, the Lutheran Church, vis-a-vis the Holy Bible, and Confidential Magazine. You'd have the polar opposites of man's dualistic nature bopping around your head if those were your two influences as well. I went to church. I still do. I still want to know the dirt, the scant, the skinny, who's got the biggest, who's got the smallest, who's doing who, who's a homo, a nympho, a lesbo, a dipso. I gotta have that shit. I was weaned on it. My parents split the sheets in 1955. I was 7 years old. I went to live with my mom. I started perving out on tall, middle-aged, good-looking redheads from the Wisconsin boonies. And I just met, by the way, the kiss, the love of my life. You could call her a redhead, but that would be to diminish her power. That's a parenthetical. That's for the Q&A. Let's flash backwards, because we're here to talk about history. It's June 22nd, 1958. My parents are divorced. My dad takes me back to my mom's pad in El Monte. The cops are there. They say, son, your mother's been killed. Where's your dad? And it's been an unsolved murder for 51 years. So my twisted, fucked up, perved out vision of America that is not quite on the up and up intensifies exponentially. And I start thinking history, living history, reading in public libraries, checking out tall redheads in windows, reading. My curriculum was mandated by tragedy and formed by the fact that although I am a high school dropout, I have read and read and read and read and read. Why do I read? To edify, entertain, jazz, fuel, console, and vibrate my own vindaloo. Where did I start to read? In public libraries, because the books were free. $29 for you, but if you ain't got the bread, it's free at the library. Just don't draw any funny pictures of me in the margins. I was in New York a couple of days ago. Publishing's pulling itself out of the slump, largely because of big early sales of this book, which each and every one of you can enhance by buying this book. And if you don't have the gelt, the bread, the dinero, the coin, you can get it free at the library. This book is about American history. It's about the private nightmare of public policy. It's about public policy gone wrong from 1968 to 1972. And if each and every one of you buy this book tonight, here are some guarantees. You will have a front row seat in heaven and an audience with all of your lost loved ones, me after my passing, and the immortal Knopf Borzoi. Yeah. And you get to meet God. If you're scoffing at all of that, here is a totally corporeal reason to go for it. If you buy this book tonight, you get to have sex with each and every person that you wanted to have sex with on earth, and there is no adultery, and nobody gets hurt. Are you getting it? There is no reason on earth for anyone not to buy this book. Clay lies still, but blood's a rover. Breath's aware that we'll not keep up, lad. When the journey's over, there'll be time enough to sleep. A.E. Hosmer, the British poet, wrote that in A Shropshire Lad circa 1920, hence the title of my novel, hence the theme of morally exhausted bad men in love with strong women. Tonight I will read two short passages, very, very short. Then I would welcome the most invasively over personal questions that each and every one of you peepers, prowlers, pederasts, pedants, panty sniffers, punks, and pimps has for me. America! I window peeped 4 years of our history. It was one long mobile stakeout and kick the door in, shake down. I had a license to steal and a ticket to ride. I followed people. I bugged and tapped and caught big events in ellipsis. I remained unknown. My surveillance links the then to the now in a never-before-revealed manner. I was there. My reportage is buttressed by credible hearsay and insider tattle. Massive paper trails provide verification. This book derives from stolen public files and usurped public journals. It is the sum of personal adventure and 40 years of scholarship. I am a literary executor and an agent provocateur. I did what I did and saw what I saw and learned my way through to the rest of the story. Scripture pure veracity and scandal rag content. That conjunction gives it its sizzle. You carry the seed of belief within yourself already. I am here to tell you that it is all true and not at all what you think. You will read with some reluctance and capitulate in the end. The following pages will force you to succumb. I am going to tell you everything. Red Fox said, Scotty was fucking a porcupine. I gots to tell you motherfuckers that it was a female porcupine, so I don't see nothing wrong with it. Yuck, yuck, the crowd laughed. Some coons off Scotty, let's get zorched and mourn. The wheelman lot, early Christmas lights and plaid bunting. Booze and jelly bean jar pharmaceuticals, you gots to love it. Crutch, Clyde, Buzz, Phil Irwin, Chick White. Milt C. on stage with Red Fox and Junkie Monkey. Ex-Governor Pat Brown and numerous pigs. 14 Black Panthers. A colored heist guy turned TV evangelist. Frau Scotty and 6 of his girlfriends. Red Fox said, Scotty popped my ass for a jump change to 11. I stole 6 moon pies, 4 bags of pork cracklings, a case of Cool T-Bird, and 10 cartons of Cool King Size. Scotty saw that I had soul and let me live. We consumed all that motherfucking shit on the premises and went out looking for bitches. Yuck, yuck. We're grief-struck, but it's fun. Frascati passed a joint to girlfriend number four. Girlfriend number five nibbled a hash brownie. Red Fox said, Scotty was out searching for this brother named Cleophas. He was a stick-up man and a booty bandit. He was robbing liquor stores with a sawed-off shotgun and banging Scotty's bitches with a piece of hard black steel 10 times that size. Girlfriend number three roared. Girlfriend number two hugged Frau Scotty. Phil Irwin popped a quaalude in the air. Chick Weiss caught it in his mouth. Governor Pat Brown blinked. Why am I here? Blood's a rover. Thanks for coming to see me, Hepcats. I realize you had options tonight. You could have stayed home and tended your sex lives and your drug habits, but you didn't. You came here to support literacy in America and the printed word versus the internet invaders. Somebody ask me a question.
Folks, raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you, and we'll start with this guy on the left here, our left. Please wait for the mic. It's right behind you.
Where can I get a jacket with a matching bow tie like yours?
This is a Ralph Lauren purple label jacket. Cost $179,000. It's made from the top dyed pubic hair of one breed of yak indigenous to one mountain in the Himalayas. Some people send their jackets out for dry cleaning. I send mine out for STD testing. Yeah!
True story. Next. Don't be shy. On our left again.
I know you've had a lot of sadness in your life. Do you think that's what really got you into writing? Or what was your start? What made you decide to get published?
I had a story that I wanted to tell. I thought that being a writer meant groovy women, six-figure sport jackets, sports cars, swinging pads, and reading gig in public libraries. But I was searching for an identity then. Au contraire, I had a story I wanted to tell. So I quit my evil ways, and I wrote a book called Brown's Requiem. And I'd been kicked out of high school, and I banged around a lot, and I was 30 years old, and I just happened to possess genius. And I found it in America's public libraries, and it was foretold by, you guessed it, the Alfred A. Knopf Borzoi. I had a book. I taught myself to write by reading for 25 years.
Next question. In the black right here.
I read My Dark Places about 10 years ago, and I seem to recall that you were able to narrow down the suspects of your wife's murder.
It was my mother. Narrowed down the suspects of my mother's murder.
Oh, really? Okay. And did you find that your attitude towards law enforcement had changed during your experience in dealing with the LAPD?
I was always pro-cop, even when the LAPD was kicking my fucking low-life ass. I did deserve it. I did deserve it. Good ass kicking from LAPD kept me on the straight and narrow. I give them every credit. I am also the yearly MC of the Jack Webb Awards for the LAPD Historical Society. And I honor the numerous ass kickings that I took from those guys every year.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Shall we continue? Good. Okay, all the way back in the... Mitch, all the way back in the green there on your left.
I think I can shout it, actually.
Now, please use the mic, because we're recording this for broadcast.
Oh, sorry about that. This really should be the last question, but
now you've finished this epic story, and I know you've got probably another project or two coming up real soon, but do you have an idea what you might do next for Infection? Is there anything more ambitious than what you've done now?
Yes, and I'm not talking about it just yet. Have you read Bloods of Rover?
About 40 pages.
Are you digging it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Bloods of Rover. Remember what happened. Remember what you get if you buy this book. Next year, Alfred A. Knopf, Home of the Borzoi, will publish my memoir, The Hilliker Curse. The subtitle is My Pursuit of Women, which has ended recently because I finally found the woman, hence the kiss. Some people have to go the hard way and find love in the end. Thank God it was me. That stated, the next four books are so earth-shatteringly Beethovenian. Beethoven's my greatest teacher, that even I can't say the name of the extended work in my mind without going into tremens.
We were playing Beethoven in the hall before you came out, Eroica.
The two hammer blows that changed musical history, 1803. Dun, dun. A big picture of Beethoven over my bed. They called him the German Elroy.
Oh, my God. Next. Right here.
Considering what you just said about the LAPD, you've been very tough on them in your books and also on Jack Webb. Can you explain that?
Well, I write about rogue factions within the LAPD many, many years ago, so there is a disjuncture there.
Yeah. Another question. There was somebody, yeah, right here, this gentleman here.
Thanks. I recently finished reading another novel about crime and corruption and police and so forth in Los Angeles. That would be Inherent Vice by Thomas Pynchon. And if you'll forgive me for mentioning another... Thanks. I guess that answers my question. I was just wondering if you had any... While I was reading it, I was thinking this is sort of like an Elroy novel. I was wondering if you had any comment
like
on it.
It's like a James Elroy book, but less entertaining. And more full of shit, right? From a guy who hasn't had his picture taken in 40 fucking years. Who doesn't go out and press the flesh and praise the dog that spawned him. Yeah, I got your vice swinging right here. Pinch him. Elroy shot a meth. Next question. Wow, just getting good.
Again, right here. Do you want to get him a mic? Peg, can you want to keep your hand up? No, please use the mic and get him.
What's the most evil thing you've ever done?
Good one, Don. Good one.
I've had some twisted fucking fantasies. Someone once asked me, in fact, it was at the Bumper Shoot Arts Festival for L.A. Confidential, the screening of the movie from my book, which is better than the movie at the same title. Man, the audience said, do you want to direct movies? I said, no. He said, why? I said, I know I wouldn't dig it. He said, how do you know you wouldn't dig it? And I said, I've never fucked a porcupine, but I know I wouldn't dig it. As Red Fox said in 1972, Scotty was fucking a porcupine. I got to tell you motherfuckers that it was a female porcupine. So I don't see nothing wrong with it. Okay? Back in the 70s, I had a fantasy of fucking a female porcupine. And that's evil. But you dig it, right? They give good quill.
We have to keep this going. Next question. Gentleman right here in the brown.
Since you brought up the adaptation of one of your films. There, I know there's a fair number of your movies that have been adapted, or a number of screenplays mm-hmm. you've written. Is there any such thing as a good adaptation, or are they, on which end of the spectrum do most, if any of them, go?
L.A. Confidential is a very fine film. But that stated, I would never criticize an adaptation, filmic, of a book that I wrote because I took the dough. And the thing about money is the color green is always flattering. The size large always fits. Sometimes, like L.A. Confidential, you get lucky. Sometimes not so.
Next. Right here again. Mitch, you want to come down halfway?
Yeah, I was wondering, am I correct that you're living back in L.A. these days after having lived elsewhere for a long time? And I was wondering how you compare it, L.A., you know, and all the changes since you grew up there. And, you know, what are your impressions these days of
L.A.? L.A., come on vacation, go home on probation. Geography is destiny. My parents hatched me in a cool locale. They dumped me in the film noir epicenter at the height of the film noir era. I moved east. I moved midwest. I moved northwest. I kept getting divorced. Brother, I didn't have any place else to go but back to L.A. There's the old L.A. in my head. There's the new L.A. that I live in. I never try to reconcile the two. If you want to know the key to my L.A., it's the back flap copy of, you guessed it, Bloods Are Over. James Ellroy was born in Los Angeles in 1948. I'm just from there.
Let's keep going right here. Do you want to just run her a mic, please? Peg?
Sorry.
Yeah, just somebody, get her a mic.
Are you ever going to teach in a college writing so we can all learn to be as fabulous as you are? Are you going to teach in a college? And also, how did you meet the new love of your life? And you're really adorable.
I didn't hear you.
How did
you meet the love of my life? We've been vibing each other for about 2.5 years. We met at a book fair. I said, ooh, when I saw her. She did not. She said, ooh, and she saw me. I did not. She's married. They tend to be. Two daughters. They all have them. Events transpired that I can only describe as being divinely deigned. You dig it? Yeah. I never say no to speaking engagements. Does that shock you? I don't read manuscripts, grade papers, but I'm very, very good at shooting my moth off and encouraging people. So you never know. Call the Borzoi. Say we want Ellroy. Feed the Borzoi. Borzoi's skinny. He needs his elbow.
Another question. Right here in the middle.
You seem to get a great satisfaction from policemen. I saw the dinner table discussion on film. I think it was Showtime with especially the homicide detectives and even riding with them. As much as you can attack cops, I think you have a great affection for them as well.
Tremendous affection. They're my people. I never attack them. I just portray rowdy elements within certain police departments. 45, 55, 65, 75 years ago, when police work was a little bit rougher and a bit more effective.
All the way in back in the black.
Mr. Ellroy, did American Tabloid start off as a... just a novel and evolve into a trilogy, or did you have it from the beginning to go that way?
Started as one-off. I saw that the historical shit that followed it was too good to bypass. The result is the concluded Underworld USA trilogy. Let's her over. Woman had her hand up in the back.
Hi. Do you have a standard writing process when you start a new novel?
Bloods a Rover is the result of a 400-page outline in which I describe all the action down to the most minute detail. It's preceded by copious notes, research briefs that people compile for me. Then I just sit in a dark room and make the shit up. History has been very, very kind to me, and I know when to adhere to history and when to extrapolate fictionally.
Hi, why did you choose to break off the trilogy just before Watergate? Was that too obvious to deal with fiction? Yeah.
It's the biggest, Watergate's the biggest yawn since Inherent Vice by Thomas Pynchon. Also, most of those motherfuckers are still alive and can sue your ass. A man asked me about my next extended work. It's so hallowed, it's so Beethoven, I can't even say the name. Look back. Earlier. Don't believe any shit you read on the internet.
Yeah, right here.
I've actually got about 40 pages left in the book, but this might be a question about your relationships, and certainly about the relationships in the book. Most of your characters are on the one end of the political spectrum, and many of them, you know, are racist, etc. And yet they're in relationships with these left-wing, way left-wing women. Is that really possible?
It's absolutely possible. And you're talking about Karen Sofakis and Joan Rosenkline? Yeah, it's true. And I owe the real-life counterparts the story. And my ex-wife, Helen Canode, who urged me to write a novel about belief and conversion.
Right back here in the way.
I've noticed that a lot of your characters tend to show up in a bunch of different books. Do you have a favorite or least favorite?
Yeah. Dwight Polly in The Cold 6000 and Joan Rosenkline in The Cold 6000. Got to read the book. On sale here.
All the way in back there in the gray. And while we're getting to him, I've got some questions that came in over the internet. This is from somebody who was at one of your other readings. So some of them are strongly worded, others are not. But would you like to make the life of a Jewish composerist completely miserable, provided you are in fact hung like a donkey?
Would I like to make the life of a Jewish composer miserable?
Composerist. It's written by a woman. No, I don't know. I can respond to her and ask her, but I don't think it is.
For a girlfriend,
Andy? No. And my girlfriend's here. I'm all set. All right, here's another one. I didn't think that was going to fall quite that flat. How does your love of Beethoven figure into your writing?
Did the Jewish composerist write this one?
Yes.
There's a woman named Erica.
It's not Erica.
In L.A. She will put the hex of the tiger woman on the Jewish composeress. And she'll be dyking out at Claire's Clan Club instantaneously. That's the power of Erica. The woman better watch out.
I'll let her know.
Yeah, juju!
But to answer the question, how does your love of Beethoven figure into your writing?
To me, Beethoven, the most unfathomable genius ever created by civilization. Think of the grandeur of it. Think of the intimacy. Think of the state of yearning the music was composed in. Then how can I falter at what I do, which is create big art? If Beethoven wrote the most transcendent and revolutionary music of all time in dire, dire poverty, ill health, and stone death. If there is an exemplar creatively for me, it's Beethoven.
Do you listen to him while you write?
Not while I write. But I have busts of Beethoven, pictures of Beethoven all over the place.
Okay, thanks. I think we had a question back there.
Thanks for coming to Philadelphia. This is a real treat.
I'm having a blast.
Couple of things, since I don't know when I'm ever going to get a chance to talk to you again, but one was that you had a detective helping you go over your mother's murder and pretty much, I think, paid his salary for however long it took and came to the same conclusion that the case is still unsolved. Right. I was curious of whatever happened to him. His name was Bill something, I believe, an L.A. County detective. And
well, I'm living in Orange County.
I was curious if you modeled any characters after him or other than just in parts.
No, Bill's inimitable.
And then the last thing, since you invited us to be intrusive, was I was curious about, with all this cash you're grabbing for writing these brilliant books, what's the most money you ever made in 1 year? And tell me the most perverted, sickest sex scene you ever were involved in or witnessed in the course of your writing.
I already talked about the porcupine. It didn't matter that it was just inside my head. I've had some very, very good years financially. They seem to run commensurate with how charitable I am and how much alimony I pay.
Ed, right here.
Where were you when Kennedy was killed?
Jack?
Yeah.
15 years old. My dad had a stroke on November 1st, 1963. I ran wild for 22 days, rarely showed up in school. He got back from the hospital in a cab that day. I was inside all morning reading Nero Wolfe novels by Rex Stout and trying to avoid my dad's cab coming home. I did not. I had a paper route then at the pad of David and Donald Runyon, our delivery boss, oddly named George Lucas. Georgie the Greek dropped off our newspapers for us. There was the big stack of papers, Kennedy assassinated. November 22nd, 1963, I was there. I was 15. Read my book, American Tabloid, if you want the inside story.
In the middle here with your hand up toward the back.
Hi. It seems like a lot of your books, like Big Nowhere, L.A. Confidential, the whole Crime USA trilogy, involve groups of three men, you know, searching for things and end up working together. And I was wondering, why three? And does that have anything to do, like you said, you go to church every Sunday with, like, the Holy Trinity? Or you know, what is it about three that you keep returning to?
It's a wonderful way to contain historical narrative, to merge storylines at the get-go, and there are many, many variations on that motif in, you guessed it, Bloods of Rotor, which starts with three men. Some fall by the wayside. You know, there's even some women who come in.
All the way in back there, and while we're going all the way in back, I have a question for you. Why do you think L.A. has become the seat of noir? I mean, I know there's Texas noir. I think of Jim Thompson, Philadelphia noir, David Goodis. Why is it L.A. has really prevailed as the...
Two things. Raymond Chandler wrote about it. And the studios filmed film noir there because it's where the studios were. And it was easy to shoot on location.
But,
that's
So no, it doesn't have anything to do with sort of the California culture or Western culture in any way.
Now this place where you went after World War II to be anonymous and be somebody else, look good in the grooviest looking place on earth. Heaven looks a lot like that. And if you all buy lots of books tonight, you'll see it.
Gentleman in back.
Hello. The only other writer I read from Los Angeles is Charles Bukowski. And I was wondering if you spent a lot of time in the library. Which writers have you admired that you enjoyed that really you felt they spoke right to you? Could you think of anyone? I guess suppose you could. Yeah, because I'm talking over the years. When you're a child or a kid, you say, hey, this guy, he kind of knows what I'm about, or he's talking to me.
Yeah. Joseph Wambaugh, Los Angeles policeman.
I remember his books, yeah. One other thing I'd like to ask you, if you don't mind.
It's a long question. Keep going.
Sometimes I get tired, my eyes get tired. I listen to books, so I listen to the book. Yeah. Are you happy with the books that... Because I think you might be good to listen to. I haven't...
The abridged version of My Dark Place is my memoir on my mother's death. It's not a good abridgment, but it's all narrative, and I got a good voice. Differentiating voices is tough, tough work. Book like this, Bloods Are Over, 100-plus characters, plus exposition, men, women, old, young, ethnic, racial spectrum, I don't have that many voices in my head. Couldn't do it.
Yeah. A couple more and then we're done. All the way in front here, the lady in the black sweater.
Thanks. Do you still drink the way your characters drink?
No, I haven't had a drink in many years and I don't use drugs.
How many 12-step programs do you currently attend?
I haven't been to any 12-step programs in a while. I'm just a sober.
Okay, let's wrap it up right here.
I'm sorry to repeat a question or to be a repeat questioner, but I first got into your stuff because of the actually the audiobook version of American Tabloid, unabridged. Do you have a preferred narrator for your stuff? Because I thought the guy who narrated American Tabloid is quite fine. I just wanted to know what you thought of the narrations of your audiobooks, because they're very good.
Craig Wasson reads unabridged, Colt 6000. On sale now, Bloods Are Over, read by Craig Wasson, is a Random House audiobook.
James Elroy.
Is that an outrageous performance? They got it, too.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.